The tape that you are about to hear has been declassified by disability and disadvantage analysts at CFMU Radio. This taped record of conversation had never been heard before being released to you, the CFMU listener. This tape has been condensed and edited from live, personal, or telephone conversation. You will hear privileged discussions, damning indictments, and stark revelations. Once known collectively only to the agents intercepting them, these files have been tagged with the distinct identifier, disrespect. Disrespect introduces Dr. John Connolly, a professor in cognitive neuroscience and brain imaging. He's been using a method developed in Finland, I believe, and continuing to develop it here for electroencephalograph readings of consciousness in people who are deemed minimally conscious or in a vegetative state. Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
How did you come upon this work and get engaged in it?
Well, actually, it's other work I do in Finland. This work that we'll be talking about today is thoroughly Canadian, I'm happy to say. So we started this about 20 years ago now, a little over, in Halifax, Nova Scotia, when I was at Dalhousie University, and I was working with a colleague at the, as it was then, the IWK Children's Hospital in Halifax.
All right.
And we were doing work with a derivative of EEG, or the electroencephalograph, those sorts of recordings, and you can get from them a variety of responses that are linked to how the brain processes a stimulus, be it a click or a sentence that carries meaning or does not carry meaning. So it's a very dynamic system that really responds to a whole range of environmental stimuli and things that we might either respond to in a sensory fashion or respond to in a cognitive fashion. And we were doing that sort of work together, and it simply just occurred to us that there was a real potential to apply this work to access patients and their mental life and access these particular types of patients, and that's patients that had problems communicating. So they were patients that would get diagnosed as being, for example, in a vegetative state or a minimally conscious state, or it could be like one of the first people we tested was someone with cerebral palsy.
Okay.
So it was really just a basic research leading to a clear application, which has been, frankly, quite successful over the last 20 years or so.
And where has it been applied?
Well, we have done work with cerebral palsy. We just finished a study with a category of autism, nonverbal autism.
Oh.
And we have applied it to stroke. In fact, I had a meeting this morning where we will be working in Hamilton, applying it to stroke patients, a wide variety of them, and also to traumatic brain injury patients.
So you're not just dealing with patients in a coma?
No. In fact, the coma work has not begun. We'll probably start that work sometime in 2012.
Okay.
Hard to say when, but we certainly have that on our agenda.
Okay. So the seat of this work, the home of this work, the origin of this work was in Halifax, but it is now taking place under your oversight in Hamilton at McMaster?
Yeah, at MAC and at the Hamilton General Hospital, the regional rehab center. Okay. I was running it when it was in Halifax, and then, well, very simply, I moved here. Mm-hmm. So I came here in 2008, and so we've set up laboratories at MAC and at the regional rehab.
All right. Well, what kind of results are you seeing here? For you working with all kinds of disabilities from the sound of it.
Yeah. Well, we're seeing what we saw before. We just want to expand the work. But basically, we saw a patient, for example, just to use one example, one patient we saw here working with a neurologist, Dr. Jane Gillette, and she had a patient that she referred to us, and in the traditional consensus diagnosis, as it's referred to, for this patient, he was in a motor vehicle accident.
Right.
He was deemed to be vegetative.
Uh-huh.
And we then did our testing, which consists of recording his EEG and then obtaining from that these responses called event-related potentials.
All right.
And they are in response to, in the way we did it with him, they are in response to things such as his own name. So he would hear, digitized as it would be on a CD, he would hear seven names just cycling through, such as Philip and John and George.
Okay.
Then he would hear his own name.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just cycle through and do this so that we had about 30 or 40 examples of each name, so a total of eight names. And then what we're looking for is he responding, is his brain responding to his own name?
Right.
Because, again, he was not responding verbally or behaviorally in any fashion at that point. And that's one type of test. Another type is we play sentences where the terminal word of the sentence either fits the context appropriately or doesn't fit the context at all, so that we would have sentences such as the pizza was too hot to sing, which doesn't make sense, and other sentences such as he takes coffee with cream and sugar.
Right.
And the brain, when it's functioning in a healthy fashion, shows two very different brain patterns to those terminal words.
Okay.
So we would present that to him. And then finally, another type of test, just as some examples, because we always do more than one type of test in case there's some anomaly with the way a person may respond to one of the tests. But another type of test is actually an adaptation of a well-known neuropsychological test that is often used with traumatic brain injury patients. And it's a test called the Peabody Picture Vocabulary Test. And basically what we do there is the person would see a picture come up on the screen of an object, and then a verbal description of that picture would be correct or incorrect. So he might see a picture of a cat and hear the word cat or hear the word teacup.
All right.
And again, the brain would show very distinct responses to each, real signatures of comprehension, as it were. And at any rate, those three tests are three tests that we ran with this fellow. And in each case, he showed quite clear responses that he was responding to his own name differentially to other names, that he was responding to sentences that did not make sense, and then also responding to words that did not match the pictures he was looking at. So these certainly were indications that, if nothing else, he had islands of cognitive activity that were still very, very functional.
Right.
And since we tested him, he was then, Dr. Gillette admitted him into a program that she ran. She very sadly died in February of 2011.
Oh.
So she was not around to see the full run of these findings, but she saw the beginnings of them, and she was very excited, and she took him into her what's called Slow to Recover program.
All right.
And he responded extremely well.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And so that's, we did further testing with him, and his responses, his brain responses also became more and more typical looking. He still showed the appropriate responses, but the general shape of them were looking more and more healthy and typical. All so right. That's the type of thing that we are doing.
All right. I understand this Slow to Recover program continues, and it continues in Hamilton. Is it funded?
Yes, as far as I know, it is. I don't really deal with that. That's done by, I assume, Hamilton Health Sciences and the hospitals, but it's certainly still operational.
All right. And it's, from what you say, it's a unique program.
It is. It's a really remarkable program, and I am a little vague on details about this. I might get this slightly wrong, but I know that the core principles of it have actually been adopted by the government of the Netherlands, for example, and I think their intent is to use it in a pediatric setting.
Oh.
So this was all started by Dr. Gillette, and she really was a terrific physician and researcher, so and had this very innovative program that is extremely successful. So,
do we use it here for pediatric as well as adult patients?
That was her intent. I don't know if that is now going to happen.
I would think at McMaster that pediatrics would not escape scrutiny.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
They may well be very interested in pursuing that.
So what have you done with conscious patients?
You said, I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
What have you done with conscious patients? You said cerebral palsy, for example, and high-functioning autism, I think it was?
Actually, not high-functioning. That's the challenge.
Okay.
What we always are doing with whatever type of patient we're dealing with, at least at the moment, we really target patients who are so compromised in terms of their communication ability that they are really disadvantaged within any healthcare system. They can't be interviewed. They can't be assessed. They're extremely difficult to. It's almost impossible to determine what is going on with them, so to speak.
Okay.
So that when we tested these children who were diagnosed as being nonverbal autism, one of the issues that comes with that diagnosis, sometimes explicit, sometimes just implicit, is the view that such people, again, nonverbal autistic people, are by definition also intellectually disabled in some fashion.
All right.
So low functioning.
And you can distinguish whether this is true or not. Yeah?
Well, that's exactly it. So again, we presented similar sorts of stimulus situations to a small group of children that were diagnosed as nonverbal autism and low functioning, and we found that they were responding to fairly sophisticated stimuli. I think responding to one's own name is not that sophisticated, but they were responding to some of the semantic examples I gave you. Whether it's the Peabody or just sentences. So they were comprehending spoken words and short bits of discourse. So that, again, suggests it may be isolated, but it certainly suggests intellectual functioning at a level that would not have been predicted by the description of low functioning.
Right. And so you're addressing this to the patients that you spoke to me about, the autistic patients, the patient with cerebral palsy and other disabilities as well.
That's right.
Okay.
That's
other disabilities that basically lock the people who suffer from them inside so they can't be assessed in other ways.
That's right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So the idea is that this allows access to an entire class of patient, in some respects, regardless of diagnosis. So it's just the class of patient being the patient that is communication impaired. And it opens the door to patients like that. to enable some level of communication. Right now, what we're doing is one-directional, so that they are it's still a passive situation for them in a manner of speaking. It's just us, in a sense, prodding their brain and seeing if it responds in a way that is typical or what we would call normal. And then it gives us some insight into what is going on with them. And I've been very fortunate with the physicians I've worked with and the various allied health people, so physiotherapy, OT, occupational therapy, speech-language pathologists, neuropsychologists, that the wherever I've been, there's always then been a response that, well, they'll start to do their work with these patients now that they know that there might be something functional in there.
So the medical response to this outside of McMaster in the Netherlands and Finland has been favorable? A new diagnostic tool, a new toy, or whatever?
Yeah, it has been. So we have published quite a number of papers on this topic. And it is being, in fact, I know it's being used or something very similar to it in several countries. I just found out about one group in Australia.
Okay.
I think there's someone in Taiwan. Well, I know there's somebody in Taiwan, for example, someone in Norway. So it's and it's been replicated. It's in some respects it's very straightforward work. It was just coming across the idea of thinking of applying these two somewhat disparate ideas together, and that's what we did, like I say, about 20 years ago, and it's worked out well.
I'm ready for a break, aren't you? This is Percy Mayfield. My mind is trying to leave me too.
I went to bed with this morning, down by the corner bar, and I thought I heard my baby call my name. I bet it came from so far. Yeah. I started running and answering. Yeah. Well, like in the crazy fool you do, I ain't lying. You see, my woman going away from me, people. And now my mind is trying to leave me too. You hear me? Am I crazy? What's this in? Well, a friend stepped out the bar and stopped me. And that dude offered me a drink. Yeah. And I went in, I had a double. And I began to think about my baby. My baby. Yeah. Well, like any crazy fool would do. Yeah, you see, my woman going away from me, Now my mind is trying to leave me too. Catch this, you know your mind will flip. Well, I went into a barber shop, and I ordered ham and eggs. Each barber gave me a half a piece, because they thought I was trying to be. I started crying like a baby. Like any crazy fool would do. Yeah. See, my woman gone away from me, partner. Now my mind is trying to leave me too. Hey, hey, hey.
You've been listening to McMaster, cognitive neuroscientist Dr. John Connolly, discuss using electroencephalographs radically to reveal vegetative states of mind or degrees of consciousness. The EEG, the electroencephalograph, does it measure responses? Well, how deep in the brain does it measure responses? If there is brain activity that's not on the surface of the brain, will the EEG pick it up? And is it significant?
Excuse me, getting a drink of water.
That's allowed.
Yes, that's a very good question, because some techniques are not so good at measuring depth, but EEG is not one of them.
Oh.
You can, with electrodes just placed on the scalp, this is non-invasive technology, non-painful, non-invasive. But just standard EEG, you can record brainstem activity.
Oh, really?
Which is basically as low as you can go.
Right.
And record everything from brainstem right up to cortex.
Brainstem being the seat of autonomic nervous activity,
yeah,
among other things.
It is really the core brain area. We share it with a lot of other animals that we think of as lower species.
Right.
So it's the oldest part of the brain.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's a very good response in that regard. There's some debate as to whether another technique, a very, very good technique called magnetoencephalography, whether that is as good at measuring depth. The suggestion is that traditionally that it is not. But there's been some recent work where that may not be entirely accurate. But certainly EEG and things like brainstem auditory evoked potential or auditory brainstem response, two different names for the same thing, you really can record, for example, different parts of the eighth nerve, then the superior olivary complex, the cochlear nucleus, very individual groups of nuclei in the brainstem,
okay.
You can get distinct responses from. Very robust.
And the EEG is the least invasive of the methods that you've looked at?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Is the EEG the least invasive of the methods that you've looked at?
No, magnetoencephalography is not invasive, and neither is MRI, magnetic resonance imaging.
Okay.
The brain imaging tools that have been used in the past, I mean, there are some things that one can do with MRI that are very valuable clinically, but they have some degree of invasiveness. But certainly, we're not in the same arena, shall we say, as positron emission tomography or CAT scans, which have issues of radiation.
Yeah.
You know, again, not dangerous, of course, otherwise they wouldn't be used, but nonetheless, they do have those elements to them, and these techniques have nothing to do with that whatsoever.
Oh, okay. You mentioned your definition of brain life. I don't know what word you would use, but let's say brain life, as one of interconnectedness, that the brain is an organ that's in constant communication with throughout the body and within, also in constant communication with itself. And it's when you observe evidence that this communication to the body and within the brain is broken down that you suspect permanent damage.
Yeah, it's one of the areas of constant debate in this research area generally is the degree to which we can infer consciousness and awareness from getting some of the responses that I've been describing to you. And because, as I used the word islands before, it's possible that one can tap into a cognitive function that has, by virtue of brain injury, become isolated from its normal neighborhood,
okay,
so to speak. But it still might be functioning. It might be the connections that normally exist to other areas that are damaged.
Right.
And that is one of the better hypotheses proposed by a fellow in New York, Nico Schiff, and also Stephen Loris in Belgium, that consciousness and disorders of consciousness, such as vegetative state, minimally conscious state, or MCS, right, that these are attributable to something akin to a disconnection syndrome.
Okay.
That you might have these pockets of activity, and the real issue is that it is this disconnection which means that the patient may be able to do some of these activities, show brain responses that indicate semantic comprehension, but still may not be conscious in the traditional sense of that word.
Maybe being able to use that information in any way.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Now, in our experience, which is limited in terms of what I'm about to describe, we have evidence from two patients that responded very well when they were in a vegetative state. They showed very good ERP, or again, the event-related potential responses to our stimulations.
Okay.
And we were able to communicate with them, to speak with them, when they made some degree of recovery. And in both cases, they remembered quite clearly.
Oh.
It wasn't dreamlike, but which is what I asked one of them quite pointedly. It was not dreamlike. He remembered very clearly the whole experience of being tested.
Really?
At the very first time. He simply couldn't show any responses except his brain responses.
Really?
A good example of this, because this sometimes is a bit difficult for people to get a handle on. There is a very good book and then a film made of that book. The both are entitled The Butterfly and the Diving Bell.
Okay.
Both originally in French. In fact, the film is French, and the book was translated from the original French. So it's Le Scaphandre et le Papillon. But it is a book that was written by a man named Jean-Dominique Bobet, who is the editor-in-chief at the time of Elle magazine.
Okay.
And was living in France, in Paris, and he had a brainstem stroke.
Oh.
And he was judged, as the book describes, he was judged to be in a vegetative state after that stroke and put in a long-stay facility, which is common practice. And it was only while he was there that a nurse discovered that he was not in a vegetative state.
How did she find that out?
Well, she just noticed when she was opening the curtains in his room that his one good eye, the other eye, was patched shut because it wouldn't blink. So she thought that he was tracking her movements across the room.
Oh.
And that is not that's not allowed, so to speak, in the diagnosis for vegetative state.
Okay.
So she just asked him, are you watching me? Blink twice for yes, once for no. And he blinked yes.
Oh.
And she then asked him several questions of, did he know where he was? Did he know what had happened to him? And he replied with his eye blinking, yes.
Oh my God.
So together they wrote this book.
Oh my
on
God.
A blink system.
Oh, really?
So she would just start with the alphabet, and he would blink, indicating that was the letter he wanted.
Oh.
So just on the blink system, they wrote this book, which is a really fascinating book. It might sound as if it would be depressing. It isn't. It's poignant at times, but he was a great character, and what's interesting is despite his original diagnosis of vegetative state, despite having a very serious stroke, people who knew him well, when they read his book at the end, they said his entire personality, his entire character just was very, very clear.
Really?
It had not been changed at all, at least as far as the way it was manifested in the book.
Right.
So it's very, very interesting, the things he says about how if you are unable to communicate back to people, you effectively don't exist, even if they're very nice people and you know they're trying to help you. If you can't give anything back, just as a species, we stop responding to you. Oh. It's very, very interesting.
Did he ever recover to any degree?
No. He lived long enough to see his book published. At least that's what I could discern from his date of death and the date of publication. But no, he did die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Wow. The Butterfly and the Diving Bell.
Yeah.
And that was his choice of title? Or the
Yes. Yes. He felt that his mind or his spirit was like the butterfly. But the Diving Bell, it's those old, I think in English they're called bathyspheres or something.
Yeah.
But it's the old diving outfits that are very, very rigid.
Right.
So basically, and that was his body. His body had just become totally rigid and not usable and not flexible.
Right.
But his mind and his spirit was still very active, and it was flying around inside this thing.
Oh, I see.
So it's quite poetic.
You spoke of the attitude of a minority of researchers at a conference to publishing the work that you've done and expanding its influence. You mentioned an incident to me that I found, although it doesn't represent the majority of doctors who you said are excited by the use of this technique, nevertheless, some of them responded differently.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I think when you are dealing with life or death issues, that there are everyone, all the physicians are there to help, but I think some people have different attitudes about what constitutes that help. So when we were talking about one aspect of this work on one occasion, it was pointed out to me that this was research, and I was not able to communicate the results to the families of the patients. And I said, that's correct. That's a very common regulation for the safety of the patients. It makes perfect sense.
Okay.
That I would not be in a position to relay the information directly to the patients' families.
All right.
And the response of one or two people was that they were glad to hear that because they had enough difficulty pulling the plug.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a long time ago in a different place than I am now. But it was a interesting response to it, because what I was talking about was cognitive functioning. Now, again, it was research, so it's all, anytime you're dealing with research, it's always open-ended questions. That's why you do it. But it was still potentially saying that these people who one previously thought, by judging them behaviorally, which in some respects, by definition, is one of their major problems, that they were not functional, but we had a method for determining whether that was accurate or not.
Yeah,
but it was just something that a couple of people, at least on their first take of this work, was not something that they wanted to hear.
You've been listening to McMaster, cognitive neuroscientist Dr. John Connolly, discuss using electroencephalographs radically to reveal vegetative states of mind or degrees of consciousness. Percy Mayfield again, a theme on consciousness, the river's invitation.
That's right. Go like this. All across the country, and I'll play in every town, 'cause I'm trying to find my baby, but no one has seen her around. Mm. Now you know of which way I'm headed. If my baby can be found, if you can't be found, I spoke to the river. Spoke back to me, yeah. And it said, you look so lonely, and you look full of misery. And if you can't find your baby, come and make your home with me. Make your home with me, yeah. I'm gonna find her, and then I'll take her for a ride. I'll take her for a ride, and then we will live our lives forever in a home among the child, and among the child.
We have this Rizzulli case been decided in favor of Rizzulli as to whether the family or the doctors decide whether you live or die.
Mm-hmm.
And at the moment, the decision's made in favor of the family, and the doctors are deciding whether they want to go back and try this case further or not.
Yeah.
Do you see something like this benefiting a case where somebody with a disability has attributed to them certain prognosis? For instance, like trisomy kids, who the health system in Ontario really doesn't seem to want to survive, but a smallish number of them, we'll never know what number because so many of them are terminated, but probably a minority of them do survive and do survive well with limits on their cognitive functioning. Is there any way to determine, is that mostly genetic we're talking about, or is there any way to determine in a cognitive way how well they will do?
Yeah, I think that's getting outside what I'm comfortable speaking about in terms of just my own knowledge. But I think that in any situation, whatever the diagnosis, the techniques I'm describing would or should be able to give you some indication of what cognitive function may or may not exist.
So is this a person or is this not? You could be answered with your techniques.
Yeah, well, certainly whether it's a person with a cognitive life or not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So...
And it sounds like when you deal with something like recognition of a name, you're reaching down to the lower levels of cognitive activity.
That's
so
true.
It's quite a broad definition of cognitive life, and it would include a lot people of a lot of different abilities.
That certainly is, because recognizing one's own name is not a very high-level activity.
Mm-hmm.
So we start earlier than that. I just haven't mentioned some of those. So we start fairly low in terms of just basic sensory function. We don't do that much of that work ourselves. We have colleagues that do that. But we start with some very low-level cognitive responses, and I think that's fairly low-level. And then we go up to things like semantic comprehension. We can get very detailed about language processing so that we have responses that will indicate phonological processing, so the processing of not just spoken words, but the sounds of them, whether a person recognizes whether it's the word was the sound that he or she expected to hear.
Okay.
So we can get fairly fine-grained about that. We can do syntactic evaluations so that if I make a grammatical error of saying something to the effect of we was going to go down to the store,
yeah,
that would produce brain responses in people that know English grammar.
Right.
And if the person in front of us, we knew prior to any injury, knew English grammar, if he or she failed to show that response or did show the response, would have very different opinions as to the level at which they were functioning.
All right.
But these responses can also measure memory functions, so it can differ. They can differentiate a variety of different types of memory. But one experiment we finished recently was just distinguishing between a sense of familiarity versus a case of recollection. So I know as I age, I'm finding an awful lot of things are familiar, but I really can't remember specifically. I can't recollect why they're familiar.
Oh.
But this is, for example, anyone listening, if they've been walking in a shopping center and they see someone, and it's someone they have a sense of familiarity with, but they just don't know why.
Okay.
And then they realize hours later or the next day, somewhat to their embarrassment, they see them every day, but it's just someone that they buy the newspaper from.
All right.
As they walk to the train.
Someone they see in another environment.
Exactly right.
The
now they've seen them, you know, at Sport Check or something, and it's just not what they're accustomed to. So
right.
the familiarity would be there, but not the ability to recollect, as opposed to someone that you see regularly, and there's the familiarity, and also then there's the recollection of, oh, well, that's my family doctor.
All right.
And there are two different brain responses that map onto that sense of familiarity versus that sense of direct recollection.
Okay.
So there's a range of cognitive functions that are really amenable to evaluation with these techniques, and that's the sort of thing we're doing. We're trying to get as full a picture of the cognitive life of these people as we can.
The research sounds widespread. What do you see for the future of the use of these techniques? EEGs are not expensive or difficult to perform, are they?
They are not. And I think that's one of the big, it's one of the things we've been advocating for some time, that EEG is the oldest brain monitoring, let's call it, technique around. And it has a certain... It's almost like products in the store that have yellow labels. I think there's a certain complacency that, oh, well, that's been around a while, as if it's not valuable anymore.
All right.
And we've been saying for 20 years that it is very valuable and arguably the best tool for doing this type of work. And I will hasten to say we use other brain imaging tools. It just depends on what our questions are. So
right.
I've in the past gone regularly to Helsinki to work with them doing magnetoencephalography, because really they're the people that, if not invented it, and even then I think many people consider that they did. They're certainly extremely sophisticated at it. It's some of the best people in the world work in Helsinki on this magnetoencephalography. But it's very expensive as one potential drawback, but it's still a very, very useful technique. fMRI, I think, is less valuable, and that was what we were saying frequently. Now, we're recording some here at St. Joseph's Hospital. We're recording EEG and fMRI simultaneously.
Okay.
And again, all of these techniques are valuable. They just provide different perspectives on a phenomenon.
All right.
So, but I think what you say is absolutely correct. That and what I'm a bit gratified to see that some of the people who have been pushing fMRI in this domain that you and I have been talking about now are now starting to publish papers saying that they've decided that EEG may be the better tool for this.
Oh, good.
So so I think that's always been the case, and that's what we've been saying, that it combines a number of things. One of them that's very important is two things in particular, is the timing. So these EEG responses have accuracy in terms of milliseconds, so
okay.
A thousandth of a second. You can see when something is changing in the brain.
Right.
That's not true of fMRI.
Oh.
That's a hemodynamic-based response, so it's much slower. And the other big advantage is that these event-related potentials, they have specific features or specific components that we know map on to very specific cognitive operations, so that given a certain stimulus situation, if we see a particular, they're called components, a particular component of one of these ERPs, then we know that that's what the person was doing in response to that stimulus situation. We,
right.
For example, know that they recognized that face on the screen.
Right.
It might be familiarity rather than recollection. We could make that distinction. Those sorts of separations are not either not as easily achieved or simply not possible with with fMRI, for example. So that varies. Some things are achievable that way, but I think in terms of ease, cost, portability, okay. All of those things favor EEG.
Oh, good. Maybe a ghoulish question, but if you wanted to be sure that these techniques were used on yourself in the event of circulatory or automobile accident,
mm-hmm.
or some kind of other event, what would you ask for in say a power of attorney or a living will or whatever?
Sorry, what would I?
What would you ask for if you wanted these techniques to be applied to you in the event of a traumatic incident?
I would. Yeah, that's a good question. It's one can advocate something, but then when it comes to the crunch, what would you opt for? Actually, my entire lab knows that if I should do that sort of thing of either have a stroke or have an accident of some description, that they just run what we've been running on the patients here. It's absolutely the best way to see what's going on in my head after this.
And what would you call that?
We call it Neurovox. We have a patent for some of this work and that sort of thing. So we've named it something specific, so it's just a shorthand way of referring to it, but it is this this adaptation of neuropsychological tests that we do that then are presented to the person, and we look at their brain responses to those, and those brain responses will tell us that even if they can't speak or move, they'll tell us that they're still processing it the way anyone would.
And this is NeuroVox, NeuroVox?
Yeah,
so
it's basically something along the lines of the brain's voice.
Very good. Yeah, very good name, too.
Yeah.
Okay. What else was there that you wanted to say about this subject?
I think that does cover it. I think it really does have potential. I think we are speaking to people. I think it's a very good feature of some of the grant agencies that we deal with, that they want to know their policy implications for some of this work. And I think those are fair questions. Sometimes they seem premature, but I think it's always good to consider them. And I think, for example, with this work, there absolutely are policy implications, so that we've had both with colleagues in Halifax, colleagues in Hamilton, we've had patients that were not going to receive treatment, not because of any negligence on the part of the health community, but simply when you cannot ascertain what is going on with a person. It's basically a triage system. You have to move to try to on to the next person who you may be able to help.
Right.
And what we've been able to do with this technology is to open up the window a bit, saying that there are some of those patients that one quite reasonably and sadly would have to walk by in the past. And there is now a way to see if that decision to walk by is true, is accurate or not. So that's really,
I think... So it's changed the triage of head injured patients.
I think it has. Okay. I think it should. It has in our own research, which is a very small section of the populations that we're talking about. But I think that is what we would be shooting for at some point, is to have this work implemented on a broader base. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for your time with us. It's a fascinating talk and a fascinating subject, especially for someone with a disability whose life may be devalued once this is known, even before any other assessments are made.
No, it's my pleasure.
Thank you very
much. Thank
you
for your interest.
You've been listening to McMaster cognitive neuroscientist Dr. John Connolly discuss using electroencephalographs radically to reveal vegetative states of mind, or degrees of consciousness. And now it's time to go get your coffee or listen to the music. At the end of the show, Charlie Musselwhite, Little Star. This is Jeff Langhorne of Disrespect Radio. I think you're here instead of listening to commercial radio because you want to. Well, something funny, I'm here because I want to, too. All our hosts on community radio are unpaid volunteers. Our management takes less than scale, so they must want to, too. Our guests, they have to want to as well. They're not looking for the big endorsement. They're not looking for big bucks. They're here because they want to talk to you, the CFMU listener. We're simulcast around the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. And we're also podcast back 6 or 7 years at this time. We're archived at radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can reach the show at disrespect@lycos.com. Come back at showtime next week on CFMU 93.3 on your radio at 12 noon on Thursdays. You know you want to.